The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We're off and running on yet another week of broadcasting here at KPCG, and the live stream is available at kpcg.fm and, of course, at the trumpet.com website as well. There's lots of stories coming out this week on the website, so make sure that you visit the website, thetrumpet.com, every day, multiple times a day, in fact. As I think we're putting up maybe four or five new stories or new postings each and every day when you count all the videos and the programs like this one, and then, of course, the articles that we're writing. You can understand your world from God's perspective by visiting thetrumpet.com. Well, some of us have been reading a little bit about Winston Churchill's early life, and there's a nice double benefit there because obviously you're learning about Churchill and his early years, but you're also reading about Churchill's life there at the end of the Victorian age, right at the end of the 1800s, when Great Britain truly was great. And of course, that's prophesied, as Mr. Armstrong writes about in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy. But when you don't have God's insight, when you don't have God's understanding of Bible prophecy, I mean, really, it's so incredible. It seems like it would be impossible for this to play out the way that it did. Churchill, of course, admired Lord Macaulay, the famous historian. His work, The History of England, I think he released that in the 1850s or 1860s, and Churchill went through it thoroughly and even tried to emulate Macaulay's writing style. But early on in his work, Macaulay's work, he introduced his subject by saying that he intended to write about Great Britain's astonishing rise from, as he said, an ignominious vassalage. I mean, a rise to the greatest of all world empires, and the start, the ignominious start for Britain. It's astounding, this story, this history. Macaulay said that the marvels of the British Empire would have seemed incredible to any statesman of a former age. And regarding Britain's naval dominance, he said Britain's maritime power made every other maritime power, ancient or modern, shrink to insignificance. And then he says a few pages into his book, or his, I guess it's a four or five volume series, but Macaulay said nothing in the early existence of Britain indicated the greatness which she was destined to attain. There was nothing there early on to indicate that this little island, and that's what it was, that this little island would become the greatest empire in the history of the world. You can't really explain it. I mean, you leave aside the Bible, and I think there were probably quite a few authors and historians and scholars at that time who actually did attribute the greatness to God, even without understanding the truth about the United States and Britain in Prophecy. But still, as he said there, I mean, nothing really in the early existence can explain this. And it's the same, really, the same history with the United States. It just happened a little bit later with the United States of America. Well, really, both of them exploded to power and influence at the same time. It's just that the British Empire, well, as Herbert Armstrong said, and this is back in 1972, he said that the 19th century belonged to Great Britain, And the 20th century, or at least the first half or the first three quarters of the 20th century, belonged to America. And you think about the smooth transition from Britain to America, the British Empire, of course, weakening through the course of two great world wars. And then after that, I mean, the United States of America, the single greatest superpower in the history of the world, the world's guarantor of global stability. I mean, it was the United States that held the peace for the most part. There certainly have been wars since the close of World War II. But for the most part, since that great war, I mean, the United States has been the world's policeman. And also, the United States has pretty much stimulated the fastest period of growth that this world has seen, certainly in areas like Europe and Asia and such. And it was the United States, of course, that held back communism all of those decades following the end of World War II. Eventually, of course, it was the United States that brought down the Soviet Empire. You have the Pax Britannica, that 19th century powerhouse, Great Britain. And then the 20th century, Pax Americana. That's what's prevailed for the most part over the past two centuries. And as I say, without God's perspective, it's really hard to explain. As Macaulay said, well, there's really nothing there in the early existence of Britain to indicate the kind of greatness that it would experience. God, of course, has an explanation, a powerful one at that. This is from Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. He said, so beginning in AD 1800 to 1803, after 2,520 years, that's referring to the 2,520 years prophecy from Leviticus 26. I'll leave that to you to study. He goes into that at great length in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy. But he says here, God did cause, this is the beginning of the 1800s, God did cause the birthright nations and them only to become suddenly the recipients of such national wealth, greatness, and power as no nation or empire ever before had acquired. Together, they, the British and Americans, descendants of only one original tribe, Joseph, came into possession of more than two-thirds, almost three-fourths, of all the cultivated resources and wealth of the whole world. These two brothers, these two descendants of Joseph, Mr. Armstrong says the most amazing fact of all history is this sudden skyrocketing from virtual obscurity of two nations, virtual obscurity. Remember Macaulay talking about the ignominious vassalage of Britain early on. He says, from virtual obscurity to the most fabulous wealth and economic power ever possessed by any people, Britain became Great Britain, a gigantic, stupendously wealthy commonwealth of nations. The United States, the greatest nation of history. That's what we became. And it happened simultaneously there in the early years of the 1800s. And look at the power. Look at the world that Churchill lived in the late 1800s. Look at the power of the United States following the end of World War II. Well, as Mr. Armstrong says, more amazing still, More amazing than this sudden spurt of power and growth are the unbelievable, shocking facts of the present, of how and why we're losing it faster than it came. Losing all of those blessings, losing all of that power, losing all of that influence. These two brothers, I mean, you see it, as I covered last week, even in the relationship of the United States and Britain. I mean, we talked at length over the course of President Obama's presidency about this severing tie between the U.S. and Britain, the not-so-special relationship. President Obama making it a point, it seemed, everywhere that he went, to say that, well, it's really no different, our relationship with Britain, as it is with any other nation. Nothing really special there to speak of. And then, of course, when President Trump came in, it looked like a fair bit of that was going to be repaired. But then look at what happened last week. There's a piece in Foreign Policy today. Donald Trump is single-handedly wrecking the special relationship. That's from Foreign Policy. And this article talks about just how close this union has been for the past two centuries. It says there are only two countries in the world whose citizens have fought alongside American troops in every single war since World War I, Britain and Australia. And of course, Australia is Ephraim as well. So here you have the same family of Joseph. It says no other American ally, friend, or partner can make that claim. Not surprisingly, the special relationship with Britain has been of the closest cooperation and trust that could ever take place between two independent nations. I mean, you're talking about an unusually close relationship. This article talks about, just as one example, Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt, how that they shared a commitment. And even when they were in disagreeing with each other, still this uniquely close and special relationship. And then more recently, of course, the Britain standing alongside the United States following the terrorist attack on 9/11. Who can forget? We talked about this at the Trumpet. This the sort of the last hurrah of the U.S. and Britain's show of power with Tony Blair working there together with George W. Bush. And it says even when the relations between Washington and London were at a low point, still you had all of these, in some cases, secretive arrangements, alliances. Britain and America have shared intelligence over the decades. Strategic nuclear secrets, this article brings out. It says, and when all of Europe refused to have anything to do with missile defense, Britain quietly signed an agreement that opened the door for the possibility of its hosting a missile defense radar. This is how it concludes. Now comes President Trump to wreck this decades-old relationship. It's bad enough that he retweeted anti-Muslim videos pushed by British extremists. It is more damaging that Trump seems to gloat over the fact that Britain has suffered from terrorist attacks while America has not. Far worse yet is his unconscionable personal attack on Theresa May. Whatever her political troubles, she continues to be a staunch supporter of her country's intimate ties to the United States. She's even prepared, at least as of the time of this writing, to welcome Trump on a state visit to Britain. It says, finally, it is true that Britain is not the power it once was. That's true. And we could add that America's not the power that it once was either. Nevertheless, the article says, in all other respects, Britain remains America's most reliable ally west of Australia. Donald Trump has stated that too many allies are free riders, but Britain is not one of them. His treatment of that country and its leader is nothing short of despicable. In the view of this writer, it says he owes, the president that is, he owes the United Kingdom and Theresa May a personal apology. Just yet another sign of these two powers weakening. Of course, they're weakening as separate entities as well, but then the relationship between these two, that Foreign Policy piece, I mean, it gives some important history, particularly since the World War II era, World War I and World War II, fighting together, the United States and Britain in prophecy, Mr. Armstrong titled his book. And we see the two of these powers in decline. Of course, the sun has long, it's long been set on the British Empire. And we see the United States following the same path. More amazing still are the unbelievably shocking facts of the present of how and why we're losing it faster than it came. We're losing all of those blessings, all of that power, all of that influence. Mr. Armstrong, in his book, by the way, The U.S. and Britain, he talks about, well, the reason for it is because after those blessings came, after the 2,520 years punishment, then the blessings came, as God had promised to Abraham. God fulfilled his promise. But like Mr. Armstrong brings out in his book, once he fulfilled his promise, once he bestowed all those promised blessings upon our peoples, then he was no longer obligated to continue giving us these many blessings and all this wealth and power and greatness. To hold on to it, I mean, we had to do exactly that, hold on to it. But we've squandered away these many blessings. And now we see so many curses setting in. I mean, you look at the reach of the British Empire. The sun literally never set on that empire. And yet look at how fast that empire was hollowed out. Look at how fast all of the assets of that empire were liquidated. Look at what two world wars did to Great Britain. Churchill was a man of empire. There was someone who said, following the 19th century and heading into the 20th century, there was someone who said about a young Churchill that if ever a man was made for the 20th century, it's Winston Churchill. In other words, he was a forward thinker. He was looking ahead. But as Manchester brings out, really, Churchill was a 19th century man. He was a man of empire. He came in looking to extend the power of the empire. That didn't really work out too well. He saved Western civilization, for sure. But Britain came out of World War II, a mere shell of itself. But nevertheless, I mean, the transition was fairly smooth. From a world dominated by that empire to one dominated by the single greatest superpower in history, the United States. It's because of this brotherhood. It's because they come from the same family. It's because of these blessings that God promised to bestow upon our people. But now you look at what's happening. Those blessings, we've squandered them away, and curses, as I say, curses are setting in, and it's happening so fast. Listen to what Herbert Armstrong had to say in one of his old radio programs. This is clip number 2.
We think we're the strongest nation on earth. My friends, in less than 20 years, we're going to find there'll be a stronger power than we on this earth. It hasn't happened yet. You're living in terrifying times, and you probably don't realize it. You're just so interested in this apparent time of peace, and you like to get it out of your mind, and it's a time when we can have mechanical and material luxuries and gadgets and things, and we're so interested in those things. We're so self-centered in our own selves and other people and the things that our hands can make, in human interests, in television, in the new kind of movies that are coming out, in everything to amuse and entertain ourselves. We don't realize how empty our lives are either.
Emptiness, and then of course just the distraction of it all. And people, as I'll read to you in just a little bit, the grave threats that there are in this world. A nuclear-armed North Korea, for example. And yet few people are talking about the threat of worldwide war. The threat of nuclear war. It seems the only time commentators even bring it up is to score political points. Oh, well, it's President Trump who's doing this or not doing this. America's run as a global superpower, it's over. And as Mr. Armstrong said there, it doesn't take long, just 20 years or so, and you'll see other powers filling that void. Well, he was a little bit ahead of his time. Maybe it didn't happen in the 1980s or the 1990s, but here we are in 2017, and you look at some of these stories that were put on my desk this morning. Boy, the decline of these two powers, the United States and Britain. God says in Leviticus 26 and verse 19 that he would break the pride of our power. He would break the pride of our power. There was a story over the weekend about, who is it? The CIA director, Mike Pompeo. I guess he's at some seminar on Saturday. And you know what's happened in, if you've been watching or listening to this program, you know what's going on in Iraq. You know what's happened now that the Islamic State has been squashed. You know that the United States has been working, basically been working together with Iran to get rid of the ISIS threat. Incredibly. I mean, we've been siding with Iran, the number one state sponsor of terror. And so ISIS is crushed. Then, as we've covered before on this program, we played that clip from Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying that, okay, the hostilities have died down. Now it's time for the Iranians to go home. And the Iraqis said, well, no, thank you. We need them to stay. They're part of our future. You go home. And then all of the statements that we've made over the years based upon Daniel 11:40 and other prophecies that Iraq, and also Psalm 83, I can add, that Iraq would fall to Iran, that Iran would take over Iraq. And that's happened. So here's the United States. Now that the hostilities, the Islamic State hostilities have died down in Iraq, here's the United States acknowledging that the Iranians have taken over. And so what does the CIA director reveal on Saturday at this gathering? This is from the Associated Press. CIA director Mike Pompeo said Saturday that he sent a letter to a top Iranian military official warning him that the United States would hold Tehran accountable for any attacks it conducted on American interests in Iraq. Pompeo, who has voiced staunch opposition to Iran, said he sent the letter to General Qassem Soleimani. I mean, that's the top dog in their military. He sent a letter to Soleimani, a leader of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, an elite Quds force, but the general didn't read it. And then it quotes Pompeo saying, I sent a note. I sent it because he had indicated that forces under his control might in fact threaten U.S. interests in Iraq. This is what Pompeo said. It's a defense forum at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation in California. Pompeo says he refused to open the letter. That's Soleimani. He refused to open the letter. Didn't break my heart, to be honest with you. And while the article doesn't say it, but I would imagine there was a chuckle in the audience. I wrote him a hot letter. He didn't open it. It didn't really break my heart, to be honest. Pompeo says what we were communicating to him in that letter was that we will hold he and Iran accountable, and we wanted to make sure that he and the leadership of Iran understood that in a way that was crystal clear. So after all of this, I mean, it sounds kind of tough what he says there at the defense forum, but if that's the U.S. position, if that's the U.S.'s strong stance, then why? You have to ask, why has the United States sided with Iran these past many years, trying to eliminate the Islamic State? Why have we handed Iraq over to Iran? Why did we do the nuclear deal? Of course, this goes before the Trump administration came along. But still, all along the way, I mean, we've been helping them and supporting them and propping them up and giving them billions of dollars. And now the best we can do is send some words, I guess. Secretary of State says it's time for the Iranians to go home. And the Iraqi president says, you go home. And now here comes a letter from the CIA director. And Soleimani doesn't even open it. Do you think this might be a fulfillment of that prophecy in Leviticus 26 and verse 19? That the pride of American power has been broken? You think about some of these stories. You think about what's happening or what has happened. The very next verse in Leviticus 26 says, and your strength shall be spent in vain. Your strength will be spent in vain. And what do we have to show for all of this fighting, all of this warfare? What is it now? 16 years, the war against terrorism. 16 years. And finally, at least in the case of one threat, ISIS dies down. And here the Iranians, they come and just help themselves to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, building the land bridge, Yemen, international terrorism. The United States and Britain in decline. That's part of the prophecy, too. There's an article here. I forget the name of the magazine. Richard gave it to me this morning. It's from the U.S. Naval Institute. With this author basically asking, you know, when are we going to start killing enough terrorists to actually eliminate the threat entirely? When are we going to kill the bad guys so that we can win? Is winning even an option? This author says here, those given the awful task of combat must be able to act with the necessary savagery and purposefulness to destroy those acting as or in direct support of Islamic terrorists worldwide. And then listen to this. In 2008, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Navy Admiral Michael Mullen, said, we can't kill our way to victory. Think about that. This is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He said, we can't kill our way to victory. Ever since, many have parroted his words. But what if Admiral Mullen was wrong? The United States has been at war with radical Islamists four times longer than it was with Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan in World War II. And these previous enemies were far more competent and aggressive than the terrorists. Is it time to kill a lot more of them? It's pretty blunt language. But here again, what's the objective? What's the objective in wars in this world? It says here, too many commanders and their operational law judge advocates have neutered U.S. military forces with far too restrictive rules of engagement and investigations. Listen to this example here. One Army Infantry Battalion commander reported that during a 15-month command tour in Iraq, 15 months, he had to endure 600 AR-15-6 investigations, most of which examined the use of force by his troops. That's in 15 months, 600 different investigations. When asked when he had time to command, he answered, exactly. Exactly. I can't even command the forces because I'm called upon continually to defend our behavior, our activities on the battlefield. It says in the article, human behavior has not changed much in recorded history. Neither have the basic tenets of war. It takes killing with speed and sustained effect to win wars. I mean, here again, we're in a world ruled by Satan the devil, and this has been the history of man. In many ways, the history of war, and the objective of war is to kill the enemy, or at least to kill the enemy enough to make them surrender. It says the notions that the U.S. military can win with precision strikes or winning hearts and minds are fantasy. Even the great victory in Operation Desert Storm was a bloody killing field. And then it gives some history, just in the history of the U.S., the Civil War, for example, that even with General Lee being a superior general to any that the North could put forward, it was Grant, Ulysses Grant, who finally came forward and killed his way to victory. That was the objective. And it forced the South to surrender. The North had the manpower advantage. And there were other factors too, the industrial might and so on. But still, it says further in this piece, this country's greatest generation killed enormous numbers of the enemy's military servicemen and civilians in World War II. General Curtis LeMay knew that if he killed enough Japanese, they would quit. While brutal by 2017 standards, his approach yielded lasting results, a productive peace with Japan that has lasted since 1945. They were finally pounded into submission, Japan and Germany. It says here, had the United States not killed Japanese soldiers, sailors, and airmen in the hundreds of thousands, it is likely that they would have fought on and the U.S. military would have been forced to kill millions in close ground combat until they finally quit. The United States and its allies did the same against Nazi Germany. While victory required taking and holding territory, the Germans and Japanese fought until it became clear to them that the Allies would keep killing them until they quit. It gives some history about what led up to the dropping of the atomic bomb and how that overwhelmingly leaders in the military then, I mean, they knew. I mean, yes, it was a decision that a lot of thought went into, but it was also a race to drop that bomb first so that the enemy didn't drop a similar kind of weapon on America or on Britain. And then, of course, there's the fact that it ended the war, finally, a war that could have gone on for many months after that, or maybe even years, with hundreds of thousands of casualties, maybe millions, added to the tally. It says, while the United States' current enemies are so-called non-state actors, they have no trouble with their identity and moral agency, yet U.S. military leadership still has not told its young men and women it's okay to kill the enemy. I mean, it's just the opposite in some ways. Like that comment from 2008, we can't kill our way to victory. Okay, then how do you get the victory? How do we win this war that's gone on for 16 years? It says, moreover, the military does not celebrate its victories. How many ticker tape parades have there been for Medal of Honor recipients in this war? What a difference. What a difference. Back then, it was celebrated. Victory. Victory in Europe. Victory in Japan. Where are the ticker tape parades today? It says, when individual warriors are adjudged to have killed the wrong target, they face conviction and imprisonment rather than being given the benefit of the doubt, as so many were given during World War II, it's no wonder that post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide levels are so high. Instead of praising its victors, the United States browbeats them. about civilian casualty numbers, how does this strengthen the U.S. military's moral agency? I mean, how does this strengthen the United States military power? 16 years and thousands of U.S. military lives have been lost, and the military still is plagued with obtuse rules of engagement and soul-crushing investigations into every action. I mean, here's an example of one battalion leader over a 15-month tour having to endure through 600 investigations. It says, finally, the military's leadership has a responsibility to push back hard when told to do anything that would dilute the fundamental responsibility to win wars. For the past two decades, the U.S. military has put more effort into combating climate change and training to prevent sexual harassment than it has into training warriors to kill the enemy. You see, just look at the military in these two brother nations, in these two cousins, Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and Britain. We talked some on this last week. Look at the direction. Look at how the military has been hollowed out, especially here in Britain. But the same thing's happening in the United States. But more than that, more than the hardware, people can get caught up just in the numbers of planes or ships or just the dollar amount spent on military in the case of the United States and say, well, no, there's no threat. There's no nation that's rising in power to compete with the United States. And God says, yes, there is. You better be watching. You better open your eyes to the truth. You better wake up to the fact that it just took two wars and a few years, a couple decades maybe. Mr. Armstrong talked about 20 years in that clip I played for you. But here was this great empire. And people in the 1890s, when Churchill was in his teens or in his early 20s, saying that we're never going to have a big war again. There's never going to be nations going against nations. It just can't happen. The empire's too great. Its wealth and power and reach is so vast. And also, I mean, we're becoming a very modern world. Do some of these things sound familiar? Well, how could anyone rise to confront the great power of the United States of America? Well, look at these other powers like North Korea. That's just a little tiny rogue state with most of its people suffering in poverty. They have the nuclear bomb now. And so what are other nations thinking as they see the United States in decline? Well, again, just to focus in on the U.S. and Britain, the pride of our power, it's been broken. Our strength is being spent in vain. And of course, the strength itself is weakening. There's another story here from the Free Beacon. An Army Green Beret officer has issued a public but anonymous rebuke of senior leaders for weakening America's special forces by lowering training standards due to careerism and push to integrate women into the elite forces. It quotes this individual. Our regiment has a cancer, and it's destroying the special forces' legacy, its capability, and its credibility. That's according to someone on the inside. He went on to accuse the leaders, the military leaders, of moral cowardice. Look, why are you lowering the training standards? Just for political correctness? Just so that we can have more women in the military? Just so that we can have more women fighting on the front lines? Does this make the United States stronger? Does this give the United States more strength? More power? More pride in its power? It's the same thing in the in Britain. Here's one from the Telegraph today. The SAS is considering adapting its grueling selection test to give women a better chance of succeeding. The elite special forces unit. Here's the special forces in Britain. It's just like with the United States. Where else is this happening? Is it happening in Iran? Is it happening in Russia? Is it happening in China? Or is it just in the United States and Britain? The elite special forces unit is thought to be looking at plans to make one of its trademark recruitment exercises easier for female candidates to complete. That's happening in the Special Air Service and then also the Special Boat Service, this article goes on to say. They're looking to revise the test, the physical test that involves carrying heavy rucksacks, it says, over a series of long marches across mountainous terrain. They've got to lower the standards. They've got to make it easier so that we can get the weaker in there, so that we can get the females in there. It says, according to reports, the SAS is considering allowing female recruits to carry lighter loads and giving them more time to complete the test. The suggestion comes after the government said it wanted to see all close combat units in the British military open to women by 2019. This is spearheaded by the government, the UK government. They want to see women right on the front lines of combat. It's not like Churchill's day in the 1890s when the men left in droves for the front lines to protect the women back home. It's not like that at all. This is a different time. We're so much more stronger and progressive than then. I mean, it's a modern time. And by the way, have you seen the U.S. power? Have you seen the power of its military? Nobody's going to rise to confront the United States. And okay, there's an occasional madman like in North Korea, but we're in a modern age. We're not going to have a nuclear war. Anyone that would say that, I mean, how could they say that? What an alarmist. What a Jeremiah. But the reality is, you've got 10 nations on this earth, nuclear-powered nations, nations with nuclear weapons, and all kinds of other conventional weaponry, just proliferating all over the earth, wars and rumors of wars, just as Jesus said. And these two great powers that maintained order in the Western world for more than two centuries, and the sun has set on Britain, and it's hard for Britain to even have a standing army of 70,000 people. And here they are, both of them, the U.S. and Britain, lowering their standards. There was a story a week or two ago that we talked about where they're lowering the standards morally as well, letting in the drug addicts. Or at least the ones that have been on drugs in the past. Used to be, no, you've got to have a pretty squeaky clean image to come into the military. After all, you're fighting for the United States of America. Those standards are lowered. We've got to get the marijuana smokers in. We've got to get the women in. We've got to get the weaker vessels in, like the Bible says. Meanwhile, you see all of these authoritarians, all of these kings and tyrants rising on the world scene. Mr. Armstrong, in his book, do you think so great a fall could not come to so great powers as Britain and America? Do you say it can't happen here? Do you think the great God who is able to give them such unprecedented world leadership and power and wealth is not able to take it away? To take it away from them and throw them, like their ancient forefathers, back into slavery? I mean, do you think it can't happen? He says, you need to open your eyes to the fact that Britain's sun already has set. You need to wake up to the fact that the United States, even still possessing unmatched power, is afraid, fears to use it. just as God said, I will break the pride of your power. I'll break the pride of your power. And so we're sending fiery letters off to General Soleimani. And he doesn't even care to open them. And so we make strong statements in the presence of the Iraqi prime minister. Okay, the Iranians need to go home. And the Iraqi prime minister says, no, thank you. Thanks, but no thanks. You guys go instead. The pride of our power has been broken. It says the United States has stopped winning wars, that America was unable, with all of its vast power, to conquer little North Vietnam, Mr. Armstrong wrote back in the 1980s. He said the United States is fast riding to the greatest fall that ever befell any nation. That's what's coming, and we're riding fast to that. As I said earlier when playing that clip, notice what else. This is what Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, said back in, I think, 1984. Here's clip one.
A time of trouble is coming, the great tribulation, such as never existed in the world until this time. Now, here is the same thing mentioned. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, greater than any trouble that ever came on the earth. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, and we are Jacob. That means the United States and Britain, when you understand where we're mentioned in the biblical prophecies. It's too bad that most people can't understand the Bible.
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1984, talking about the time of Jacob's trouble, where it's aimed primarily at the United States and Britain. He was building on the prophecy in Jeremiah 30, obviously. Jacob's trouble, a time of great tribulation. This article at Newsweek refers to the North Korean threat and how that this world today, and the United States in particular, is not prepared for the scale of casualties. And so we don't talk about it. Or if we do, like I said earlier, we just use it to score political points. Newsweek says here, thermonuclear weapons, colloquially, well, you know the word, I'm not going to try to say it, known as H-bombs, produce much larger yields of destructive power than the nuclear weapons that countries tested in the early days of nuclear weapon development. It says used on a densely populated urban center like New York City or Tokyo, just one weapon would kill millions of people and produce millions of casualties. So it's not like Hiroshima or Nagasaki. It's not like 100,000. We're talking like millions. And it says now, with poor and unstable North Korea joining the thermonuclear club, other small nations may realize that this previously difficult threshold may be within their technical reach. I mean, they're looking at North Korea, these other small, poor nations, these rogue states, thinking that, well, if North Korea can do it, then we can do it. It says even worse, nations around the world know that the Earth is getting to be a much more dangerous place when a nation like North Korea has such weapons. And many will perceive that their national safety now depends on procuring these terrible devices as well. I mean, this is Newsweek doing a fairly good job in this case, surprisingly, of stating that the nations of this world, they know the world's getting more dangerous. And North Korea, of course, they've been saying all along that we've got to get this as a security blanket. We've got to get the nuclear bomb so that the bigger nations will leave us alone. So that they know if they come upon us or they come after us, we've got the bomb. And then you've had all the rhetoric back and forth. But what's interesting in this article, it makes several good points. It says here, despite repeated headlines about the growing possibility of nuclear war, most people curiously avoid thinking or talking about it. See, here we are. Here we are in 2017, and you've got something like 16,000 of these bombs around the Earth, just dotting the landscape. And any one of them, as I said, any one of them, as this article brings out, if it's dropped in a major population center, you're talking about millions of casualties. But despite all these recent headlines, most people, they just avoid even thinking about it. This author here says, in over 1,000 lectures on nuclear war medical response, that's the field that he's in, I find even medical audiences do not want to address the issue. I mean, these are the ones that are going to be supposedly responsible for looking after or caring for the survivors of a tragedy like this. And they don't even want to address the issue. We just want to pretend like it'll never happen. Those bombs will never be used. The buttons will never be pushed. There was a lot of that kind of thinking in the 1890s as well, as I said earlier, in the lead up to World War I. And then after that, that was the war to end all wars, remember? And then look at what happened just a few short years after that. Just a little bit of a recess, as Churchill said, that period between World Wars I and II. And well, the recess has been a little bit longer this time. And you can thank the smooth transition from the British Empire over to the American superpower. You can thank that smooth transition, basically. But now we see the sun setting on the world's great superpower, just like it's set on the British Empire. And we have to tell you about the reality. We have to tell you what so many in this world want to avoid even thinking about. And that is the reality of Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. The reality of these weapons, these bombs, being used. Listen to what Herbert Armstrong said back in a sermon he gave in 1983. This is clip 4.
And everyone is beginning to realize now that we have come to the place where a nuclear war can blast all humanity out of existence, not leaving a man, woman, or child alive on the face of the earth, and that includes every one of us. Now, in a world of absolutely awesome progress, and yet a world of appalling evils, as I've said so very many times, are we now reaching the end of human existence? Are we reaching human extinction from this planet? Is the crowning achievement of technology and science and massive governmental production going to be the Frankenstein that will destroy us all and blot out all humanity? World leaders are bewildered. I talk to many of them. Perhaps I've talked to more in their own home offices than any other man alive recently. They're absolutely helpless. They have no solutions. They're bewildered. They don't know how to face the future. Why?
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1983 talking about his interaction with world leaders, and he met with a lot of them. And he said they're just helpless. They don't have the solutions. They don't know how to face the future. And so many today, as I read there at the end of that Newsweek piece, here we are. I mean, here we are, what, 35, nearly 40 years on from when he made that statement, that message. And you have people even avoiding the topic. They don't even want to think about this reality. They don't even want to think about this possibility. But as Mr. Armstrong said in another clip, I've played this before a time or two, the unthinkable will happen. Jesus said that it would. Make sure if you haven't gone through that latest trumpet issue yet, King Me. That's the latest magazine. just came out in the mail just this past week, last week. You see the rise of all of these authoritarian leaders. I saw another story today. I didn't bring it down here with me. The demise of term limits. As we're seeing these authoritarians come into power, and they're just doing away with all of the strictures and the balances that were once put upon their power. That's the world of today. That latest Trumpet magazine, I tell you, it has a lot. It has a lot in there. It's just packed. Every issue we produce is that same way. But so much to keep our eyes on. Watch and pray always, Jesus said. Well, I had some material here on Daniel 5 about the handwriting being on the wall. And, of course, Matthew 24, that Olivet prophecy. We can't refer to that quite enough as well. That new booklet by my father, Nuclear Armageddon, is at the door. I mean, that book came out at the perfect time. God was behind it, even the timing of it. It's really what this world desperately needs. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, as I've gone a little bit long with segment one. The program is over. Email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.